alive for as long as he can by performing an act of defilement on people of his own faith. None of them meets his eye. He has heard what other prisoners say about these men and the privileged position they occupy. Housed separately, receiving extra rations, having warm clothing and blankets to sleep under. Their lives parallel his, and he feels a sinking in his gut at the thought that he too is despised for the role he plays at the camp. Unable to express in any way his solidarity with these men, he walks on. They are led to a large steel door. In front of it stands a guard.
"It's all right, all the gas is gone. We need to send them to the ovens, but can't until you identify the correct numbers."
The guard opens the door for Lale and Beretsky. Pulling himself up to his full height, Lale looks Beretsky in the eye and sweeps his hand from left to right. "After you." Beretsky bursts out laughing and slaps Lale on the back.
"No, after you."
"No, after you,"
Lale repeats.
"I insist, Tetoviera." The SS officer opens the doors wide, and they step into a cavernous room. Bodies, hundreds of naked bodies, fill the room. They are piled up on each other, their limbs distorted. Dead eyes stare. Men, young and old, children at the bottom. Blood, vomit, urine and feces. The smell of death pervades the entire space.
Lale tries to hold his breath. His lungs burn. His legs threaten to give way beneath him. Behind him, Beretsky says, "Shit." That one word from a sadist only deepens the well of inhumanity that Lale is drowning in.
"Over here,"
an officer indicates, and they follow him to a side of the room where two male bodies are laid out together. The officer starts talking to Beretsky. For once, words fail him, and he indicates that Lale can understand German.
"They both have the same number. How could that be?"
he asks.
Lale can only shake his head and shrug his shoulders. "How the hell should I know?"
"Look at them. Which one is correct?"
the officer snaps.
Lale leans down and takes hold of one of the arms. He is grateful for a reason to kneel and hopes it will stabilize him.
He looks closely at the numbers tattooed on the arm he holds.
"The other?"
he asks. Roughly, the other man's arm is thrust at him. He looks closely at both numbers.
"See here. This is not a 3. It's an 8. Part of it is faded, but it's an 8.
The guard scribbles on each cold arm the correct numbers.
Without asking for permission, Lale gets up and leaves the building. Beretsky catches up with him outside where he is doubled over and breathing deeply.
Beretsky waits a moment or two.
"Are you all right?"
"No. I'm not fucking all right.
You bastards. How many more of us must you kill?"
"You're upset. I can see that."
Beretsky is just a kid. An uneducated kid. But Lale can't help wondering how he can feel nothing for the people they have just seen. The agony of death inscribed on their faces and twisted bodies.
"Come on, let's go,"
says Beretsky.
Lale pulls himself up to walk beside him, though he cannot look at him.
"You know something, Tetoviera. I bet you're the only Jew who ever walked into an oven and then walked back out of it."
He laughs loudly, slaps Lale on the back, and strides off ahead.
Chapter 15.
Lale walks determinedly from his block and across the compound.
Two SS officers approach him, rifles at the ready. Without breaking step, he holds up his bag. Politische Abteilung.
The rifles lower, and he passes without another word. Lale enters the women's camp and heads immediately to Block 29, where he is met by the capo, who leans against the building, looking bored.
Her charges are away working. She doesn't bother to move, as he approaches her and takes from his bag a large block of chocolate. Having been warned by Beretsky not to interfere in the relationship between the Tetoviera and prisoner 34902, she accepts the bribe.
Please bring Gita to me. I'll wait inside.
Stuffing the chocolate down her ample bosom and shrugging her shoulders, the capo sets off to the administration building. Lale goes inside the barracks block, shutting the door behind him.
He doesn't have to wait long. A flash of sunlight, the door opens, tells him she has arrived. Gita sees him standing in the semi-dark, his head bowed.
You!
Lale takes a step towards her. She steps back, hard up against the shut door, clearly distressed.
Are you all right, Gita? It's me.
He takes one step closer and is shocked by her visible trembling.
Say something. Gita, you,
she repeats.
Yes, it's me, Lale.
He takes hold of her two wrists and tries to hold them tightly.
Have you any idea what goes through your head when the SS come for you? Any idea at all? Gita, how could you? How could you let the SS take me?
Lale is dumbfounded. He relaxes his grip on her wrists, and she pulls free and turns away.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to frighten you. I just asked your capo to have you brought here. I needed to see you. When someone is taken away by the SS, they are never seen again, do you understand? I thought I was being taken to die, and all I could think of was you. Not that I might never see my friends again, not Silke who watched me go, and who must be so upset, but that I would never see you. And here you are.
Lale is ashamed. His selfish need has caused his beloved this distress.
Suddenly she runs at him with her fists raised. He reaches out to her as she crashes into him. She strikes him in the chest and tears stream down her face.
Lale takes the hits until they subside. Then slowly he lifts her face, wiping away tears with his hand and attempting to kiss her.
As their lips meet, Gita pulls away, glaring at him. He holds out his arms for her to come back to him. Seeing her reluctance, he lowers them. She runs at him again, this time knocking him back against a wall as she tries to tear his shirt off. Stunned,
Lale holds her at arm's length, but she will have none of it and pushes herself hard against him, kissing him violently. He lifts her from her bottom, and she wraps her legs around his waist, kissing so hungrily that she bites his lips. Lale tastes the salt of blood, but kisses her back, stumbling onto a nearby bunk where they tumble down together, tearing at each other's clothes.
Their lovemaking is passionate, desperate. It is a need so long in the making that it cannot be denied. Two people desperate for the love and intimacy they fear they will otherwise never experience.
It seals their commitment to each other, and Lale knows at this moment that he can love no other.
It strengthens his resolve to go on another day, and another day, for 1,000 days, for however long it takes for them to live by his words to Gita, to be free to make love, whenever, wherever we want.
Exhausted, they lie in each other's arms. Gita falls asleep and Lale spends a long time just looking at her. The physical fight between them is over, replaced by a raging tumult within Lale.
What has this place done to us? What has it made us become? How much longer can we go on? She thought it was all ending today. I caused that pain. I must never do that again. He touches his lip, winces. It breaks his dark mood and he smiles at the thought of where the pain has come from. He gently kisses Geeta awake.
"Hi there,"
he whispers. Geeta rolls onto her stomach and looks at him, troubled.
"Are you all right? You looked... I don't know. Even though I was upset when I came in, now that I think about it, you look terrible."
Lale closes his eyes, sighing deeply.
"What happened?" "Let's just say I took another step into the abyss, but got to step back out of it. Will you tell me one day?"
"Probably not. Don't push it, Geeta." She nods.
"Now, I think you'd better go back to the office so Silka and the others can see that you're okay." "I want to stay here with you forever."
"Forever is a long time."
"Or it could be tomorrow,"
she says.
"No, it won't be."
Geeta turns her head away, blushing, closing her eyes.
"What are you thinking?"
he asks.
"I'm listening. To the walls."
"What are they saying?"
"Nothing. They're breathing heavily. Weeping for those who leave here in the morning and do not return at night."
"They are not weeping for you, my love."
"Not today. I know that now."
"Or tomorrow. They will never weep for you.
Now get out of here and get back to work."
She curls into a ball.
"Can you go first? I need to find my clothes."
After one last kiss, Lale scrambles around for his clothes. Dressed, he gives her another quick kiss before leaving.
Outside the block, the capo is back in her position against the wall.
"Feeling better, Tito Vieira?"
"Yes, thanks."
"The chocolate is lovely. I like sausage, too."
"I'll see what I can do."
"You do that, Tito Vieira. See you."
Chapter 16, March 1944.
The knock on his door wakes Lale from a deep sleep.
He opens up gingerly, half expecting to see one of the Romani boys. But two young men stand in the doorway, glancing this way and that, clearly frightened.
"What do you want?"
Lale asks.
"Are you the Tito Vieira?"
one of them asks in Polish.
"Depends who's asking."
"We need the Tito Vieira. We were told he lived here,"
says the other boy.
"Get in here before you wake the babies."
Lale shuts the door behind the boys and indicates for them to sit on the bed.
They are both tall and skinny and one has a smattering of freckles.
"I'll ask again, what do you want?"
"We have a friend,"
the freckled boy stammers.
"Don't we all?"
Lale interrupts.
"A friend is in trouble."
"Aren't we all?"
The two boys look at each other, trying to decide whether to continue.
"I'm sorry, go on."
"He got caught, and we're scared they're going to kill him."
"Caught? Doing what?"
"Well, he escaped last week and they caught him and brought him back here. What do you think they are going to do to him?"
Lale is incredulous.
"How the hell did he escape? And how was he then stupid enough to get caught?"
"We are not sure of the full story."
"Well, he'll be hanged. Probably first thing tomorrow morning. You know that's the punishment for trying to escape, let alone actually succeeding."
"Can you do anything? People say you can help."
"I can help if you want some extra food, but that's about it."
"Where is the boy right now?" "He's outside."
"Outside this building?"
"Yeah."
"For God's sake, get him in here at once,"
Lale says, opening the door. One of the boys hurries outside and soon returns with a young man, head bowed, shivering with fear. Lale points to the bed and he sits. His eyes are puffy.
"Your friends told me you escaped."
"Yes, sir."
How did you do that?
Well, I was working outside and I asked the guard if I could take a crap. He told me to go into the trees because he didn't want to smell it. Then when I went to return to my detail, they were all walking off. I was worried if I ran after them, I might get shot by one of the other guards, so I just walked back into the forest.
And? Asked Lale.
Well, I kept walking, didn't I? Then I got caught when I went into a village to steal some food. I was starving. The soldiers saw my tattooed number and brought me back here.
And now they're going to hang you tomorrow morning, right?
The boy's head drops. Lale reflects that this is how he will look tomorrow when the life has been strangled from him.
Is there anything you can do to help us, little Vieira?
Lale paces his small room.
He pulls up the boy's sleeve and studies his number. One of mine. He returns to pacing. The boys sit silently. Stay here, he says firmly, grabs his bag and hurries from the room.
Searchlights scan the compound outside, as do violent eyes looking for someone to kill. Hugging buildings, Lale makes his way to the administration block and enters the main office. He is instantly relieved to see Bella behind the desk. She looks up at him.
Lale, what are you doing here? I have no work for you.
Hi, Bella. Can I ask you something?
Sure. Anything. You know that, Lale.
When I was here earlier today, did I hear talk of a transport going out tonight?
Yes. There's one leaving for another camp at midnight.
How many on it?
Bella picks up a running sheet nearby.
100 names. Why?
Names. Not numbers.
No, they are not numbered. They only arrived earlier today and are being sent to a boys' camp. No one is numbered there.
Can we squeeze one more onto that list?
I guess so. Who,
you? No. You know I'm not leaving here without Geeta. It's someone else. The less you know, the better.
All right. I'll do that for you. What's his name?
Shit,
Lale says.
I'll be right back.
Furious with himself, Lale makes haste back to his room.
Your name? What's your name?
Mendel.
Mendel what?
Sorry, Mendel Bauer.
Back at the office, Bella adds to the bottom of the typed list.
Won't the guards question a name not typed like the others? Lale asks.
No, they're too lazy to question that. It would create too much trouble for them to get involved. Just tell whoever it is to be in the compound when he sees the truck loading up.
From his bag, Lale takes a ring encrusted with rubies and diamonds and hands it to Bella.
Thank you. This is for you. You can either keep it or sell it. I'll make sure he is at the transport.
Back in his room, Lale sweeps Mendel's two friends off the bed, takes out his bag and sits down beside him.
Give me your arm.
As the boys look on, Lale sets about changing the number into a snake. The job isn't perfect, but good enough to conceal the numbers.
Why are you doing this?
One of the boys asks.
Where Mendel is going, no one is numbered. It wouldn't take long for his number to be seen, and then he would be right back here to keep his appointment with the hangman.
He finishes the job and turns to the two boys looking on.
You two get back to your block now and go carefully. I'm only good for one rescue per night, he says. Your friend won't be here tomorrow. He's going out on a transport at midnight. I don't know where he's going, but wherever it is, he will have at least a chance of staying alive. Do you understand?
The three boys hug and make promises to catch up on the other side of this nightmare. When the friends have gone,
Lale sits back down beside Mendel.
You'll stay here until it's time to go. I'll take you to the transport and then you're on your own.
I don't know how to thank you.
If you manage to escape again, don't get caught. That will be thanks enough for me.
A short while later, Lale hears the
telltale sounds of movement in the compound.
Come on, Time to go.
Sneaking out, they edge along the walls of the building until they can see two trucks loading men.
Move quickly, and try to get in the middle of one of the lines. Push your way in, and give them your name when asked.
Mendel hurries off and manages to get in a line. He wraps his arms around himself to ward off the cold, and to protect the snake he now bears.
Lale watches as the guard finds his name and ushers him on board. As the engine starts up and the truck moves off, Lale slinks back to his room.
Chapter 17. The months that follow are particularly harsh. Prisoners die in all manner of ways. Many are taken by disease, malnutrition, and exposure to the cold. A few make it to an electrified fence, killing themselves. Others are shot by a tower guard before they can.
The gas chambers and crematoria are also working overtime, and Lale and Leon's tattooing stations teem with people as tens of thousands are transported to Auschwitz and Birkenau. Lale and Gita see each other on Sundays when possible. On those days, they mingle among other bodies, sneaking touches. Occasionally, they can steal time together alone in Gita's block. This keeps them committed to staying alive, and in Lale's case, planning a shared future. Gita's capo is getting fat from the food Lale brings her. On occasion, when Lale is prevented from seeing Gita for an extended period, she asks outright,
"When is your boyfriend coming next?"
On one Sunday, Gita finally, after repeated requests, tells Lale what is going on with Silke.
"Silke is the plaything of Schwarzhuber."
"Oh, God. For how long has it been going on?"
"I don't know exactly. A year, maybe more."
"He's nothing more than a drunken, sadistic bastard,"
Lale says, clenching his fists.
"I can only imagine how he treats her."
"Don't say that. I don't want to think about it."
"What does she tell you about their time together?"
"Nothing. We don't ask.
I don't know how to help her." "He'll kill her himself if she rejects him in any way. I suspect Silke's already worked that out, otherwise she would have been dead long ago. Getting pregnant is the biggest worry."
"It's all right. No one is going to get pregnant. You have to be, you know, having your monthly cycle for that to happen. Didn't you know that?"
An embarrassed Lale says,
"Well, yes, I knew that. It's just that it's not something we've talked about. I guess I didn't think."
"Neither you nor that sadistic bastard need to worry about Silke or me having a baby, okay?"
"Don't compare me to him. Tell her I think she's a hero, and I'm proud to say I know her."
"What do you mean, hero?"
"She's not a hero," Gita says, with some annoyance. "She just wants to live. And that makes her a hero. You're a hero too, my darling. That the two of you have chosen to survive is a type of resistance to these Nazi bastards. Choosing to live is an act of defiance, a form of heroism."
"In that case, what does it make you?"
"I have been given the choice of participating in the destruction of our people, and I have chosen to do so in order to survive. I can only hope I am not one day judged as a perpetrator or a collaborator." Gita leans over and kisses him.
"You are a hero to me."
Time has run on, and they are startled when other girls start returning to the block.
They are fully clothed, and so Lale's exit is not as embarrassing as it might otherwise have been.
"Hello. Hi, Dana. Lovely to see you. Girls, ladies," he says as he leaves.
The capo, in her normal position at the entrance to the building, shakes her head at Lale.
"You need to be out of here when the others return, okay, Tato Vieira?" "Sorry, won't happen again."
Lale moves around the compound with half a spring in his step.
He is surprised when he hears his name and looks around to see who's calling him. It's Victor. He and the other Polish workers are heading out of the camp. Victor summons him over.
Hi, Victor. Yuri. How are you doing?
Not as good as you, by the look of it. What's going on?
Lale waves his hand.
Nothing, nothing.
We have supplies for you. I thought we wouldn't be able to hand them over. Have you got room in your bag?
Absolutely. Sorry. I should have come and seen you sooner, but I... was busy.
Lale opens his bag and both Victor and Yuri fill it. There is too much to fit in.
Do you want me to bring the rest back tomorrow? Victor asks.
No, I'll take it. Thanks. I'll see you tomorrow with payment.
There is one girl beside Silke, among the tens of thousands in Birkenau, whom the SS have let keep her hair long. She is about Gita's age.
Lale has never spoken to her, but he has seen her from time to time. She stands out with her flowing blonde mane.
Everybody else tries as best they can to hide their cropped heads beneath a scarf, often torn from their shirt.
Lale had asked Baretsky one day what the deal was with her. How is she permitted to keep her hair long?
On the day she came into the camp, Baretsky answered, Commandant Hurst was at the selections. He saw her, thought her quite beautiful, and said her hair was not to be touched.
Lale has often been astounded by the things he sees in both camps. But for Hurst to think only one girl is beautiful out of the hundreds of thousands who have come through truly confounds him. As Lale hurries back to his room with a sausage shoved down his pants, he turns a corner, and there she is, the only beautiful girl in the camp, staring at him. He makes it back to his room in record time.
Chapter 18. Spring has chased away the bitterest demons of winter. The warmer weather offers a ray of hope to everyone who has survived the elements along with their captors' cruel whims. Even Baretsky is behaving less callously.
I know you can get things, Titoviera, he says, his voice lower than usual.
I don't know what you mean, says Lale.
Things. You can get them. I know you have contacts from the outside.
What makes you say that?
Look, I like you, okay? I haven't shot you, have I?
You've shot plenty of others.
But not you. We're like brothers, you and I. Haven't I told you my secrets?
Lale chooses not to challenge the brotherhood claim.
You talk, I listen, says Lale.
Sometimes you have given me advice, and I have listened. I've even tried writing nice things to my girlfriend.
I didn't know that.
Now you do, says Baretsky, his expression earnest. Now listen. There's something I want you to try to get for me.
Lale is nervous that someone might overhear this conversation.
I told you.
It's my girlfriend's birthday soon, and I want you to get me a pair of nylon stockings to send to her.
Lale looks at Baretsky in disbelief.
Baretsky smiles at him.
Just get them for me, and I won't shoot you, he laughs.
I'll see what I can do.
It might take a few days.
Just don't take too long.
Anything else I can do for you?
Lale asks.
No. You've got the day off. You can go and spend time with Gita.
Lale cringes. It's bad enough that Baretsky knows Lale spends time with her, but how he hates hearing the bastard say her name. Before doing what Baretsky has suggested, Lale goes looking for Victor. He eventually finds Yuri, who tells him Victor is sick and not at work today. Lale says he is sorry to hear that and walks off.
Can I do something for you?
Yuri asks. Lale turns back. I don't know. I have a special request. Yuri raises an eyebrow.
I might be able to help.
Nylon stockings. You know, the things girls wear on their legs.
I'm not a kid, Lale. I know what nylons are. Could you get me a pair?
Lale reveals two diamonds in his hand.
Yuri takes them.
Give me 2 days. I think I can help you.
Thanks, Yuri. Send my best to your father. I hope he's feeling better soon.
Lale is crossing the compound to the women's camp when he hears the sound of an aircraft. He looks up as a small plane flies low over the compound and begins to circle back. So low that Lale can identify the symbol of the United States Air Force.
A prisoner shouts out,
"It's the Americans! The Americans are here!"
Everyone looks up. A few people start jumping up and down, waving their arms in the air.
Lale looks over at the towers surrounding the compound and notices the guards on full alert, training their rifles down into the compound where the men and women are making a commotion.
Some of them are simply waving to get the attention of the pilot. Many others are pointing towards the crematoria and screaming,
"Drop the bombs! Drop the bombs!"
Lale considers joining in as the plane flies over a second time and circles for a third pass.
Several prisoners run towards the crematoria, pointing desperate to get their message across.
"Drop the bombs! Drop the bombs!"
On its third pass over Birkenau, the plane gains height and flies off. The prisoners continue to shout. Many drop to their knees, devastated that their cries have been ignored.
Lale begins to back up against the nearby building, only just in time.
Bullets rain down from the towers onto those in the compound, hitting dozens of people too slow to move to safety.
Faced with the trigger-happy guards, Lale decides against organizing to see Geeta.
Instead, he goes back to his block, where he is greeted by wailing and crying. The women cradle young boys and girls who have suffered bullet wounds.
"They saw the plane and joined the other prisoners, running around in the compound," says one of the men. "What can I do to help?"
"Take the other children inside. They don't need to see this."
"Sure."
"Thanks, Lale. I'll send the old women in to help you. I don't know what to do with the bodies. I can't leave them here."
"The SS will be around to pick up the dead, I'm sure." It sounds so callous, matter of fact. Tears burn behind
Lale's eyes. He shuffles on the spot.
"I'm so sorry."
"What are they going to do with us?"
the man says.
"I don't know what fate lies in store for any of us. To die here? Not if I can help it. But I don't know."
Lale sets about gathering the young boys and girls to shepherd them indoors.
Some cry. Some are too shocked to cry. Several of the older women join him. They take the surviving children to the far end of the block and start telling them stories. But this time they don't work. The children cannot be comforted. Most of them remain in a silent state of trauma.
Lale goes to his room and returns with chocolate, which he and Nadia break up and offer around.
Some of the children take it. Others look at it, as if it too will harm them. There is nothing more he can do. Nadia takes him by the hand, raising him to his feet.
"Thank you. You have done all you can."
She brushes his cheek with the back of her hand.
"Leave us now."
"I'll go and help the men,"
Lale responds in a faltering voice.
He staggers off outside. There, he helps the men gather the small bodies into a pile for the SS to take away. He notices they are already picking up the bodies that lie in the compound.
Several mothers refuse to hand over their precious children, and it is heartbreaking to Lale to see small lifeless forms being wrenched from their mother's arms.
Yishkadal, Vishkadash, Shmei Rabbah. May his name be magnified and made holy.
Lale recites the Kaddish in a whisper.
He doesn't know how or with what words the Romani honor their dead. It feels a reflex to respond to these deaths in a way he has always known. He sits outside for a long time looking skyward, wondering what the Americans had seen and thought.
Several of the men join him in silence. A silence that is no longer quiet. A wall of grief surrounds them.
Lale thinks about the date. The 4th of April, 1944.
When he'd seen it on his worksheets that week, April had jarred with him. April. What was it about April? Then he realized. In 3 weeks' time, he will have been here for 2 years.
2 years?
How has he done it? How is he still breathing when so many aren't? He thinks back to the vow he made at the beginning. To survive and see those responsible pay. Maybe, just maybe, those in the plane had understood what was going on and rescue was on the way. It would be too late for those who died today, but maybe their deaths would not be entirely in vain.
Hold that thought. Use it to get out of bed tomorrow morning, and the next morning, and the next.
The twinkling of stars overhead is no longer a comfort. They merely remind him of the chasm between what life can be and what it is now. Of warm summer nights as a boy, when he would sneak outside after everyone had gone to bed, to let the night breeze caress his face and lull him to sleep. Of the evenings he spent with young ladies, walking hand in hand in a park, by a lake, their way lit by thousands of stars above. He used always to feel comforted by the heavenly roof of the night sky.
Somewhere my family will be looking at the same stars now, and wondering where I am. I hope they can get more comfort from them than I can.
It was in early March 1942 that Lale said goodbye to his parents, brother and sister, in his hometown of Krompachi.
He had given up his job and apartment in the city of Bratislava the previous October. He had made this decision after catching up with an old friend, a non-Jew who worked for the government.
The friend had warned him that things were changing politically for all Jewish citizens, and that Lale's charm would not save him from what was coming.
His friend offered him a job that he said would protect him from persecution. After meeting with his friend's supervisor, he was offered a job as an assistant to the leader of the Slovakian National Party, which he took. Being part of the SNP was not about religion. It was about keeping the country in the hands of Slovakians.
Dressed in a party uniform, which too closely resembled a military uniform, Lale spent several weeks traveling around the country, distributing newsletters and speaking at rallies and gatherings.
The party tried in particular to impress on the youth the need to stand together, to challenge the government, who were utterly failing to denounce Hitler and offer protection to all Slovaks.
Lale knew all Jews in Slovakia had been ordered to wear the yellow Star of David on their clothing when out in public.
He had refused. Not out of fear, but because he saw himself as a Slovakian. Proud, stubborn, and even, he conceded, arrogant about his place in the world. His being Jewish was incidental, and had never before interfered with what he did and who he befriended. If it came up in conversation, he acknowledged it and moved on. It was not a defining trait for him. It was a matter discussed more often in the bedroom than in a restaurant or club. In February 1942, he was given advanced warning that the German Foreign Ministry had requested that the Slovakian government begin transporting Jews out of the country as a source of labor. He requested leave to visit his family, which was granted, and was told he could return to his position in the party at any time, that his job there was secure. He never considered himself naive. Like so many living in Europe at the time, he was worried about the rise of Hitler and the horrors that the Führer was inflicting on other small nations, but he couldn't accept that the Nazis would invade Slovakia. They didn't need to. The government was giving them what they wanted, when they wanted it, and posed no threat. Slovakia just wanted to be left alone. At dinners, and at gatherings with family and friends, they sometimes discussed the reports of Jewish persecution in other countries, but they did not consider that as a group, Slovakian Jews were particularly at risk.
And yet, here he is now. 2 years have passed. He lives in a community largely split into two, Jewish and Romani, identified by their race, not their nationality, and this is something Lale still cannot understand. Nations threaten other nations.
They have the power. They have the military. How can a race spread out across multiple countries be considered a threat? For as long as he lives, be it short or long, he knows he will never comprehend this. Chapter 19.
Have you lost your faith? Gita asks, as she leans back into Lale's chest at their place behind the administration building.
She has chosen this moment to ask the question, as she wants to hear his response, not see it.
Why do you ask?
He says, stroking the back of her head.
Because I think you have,
she says.
And that saddens me.
Then clearly you haven't.
I asked first. Yes, I think I have.
When?
The first night I arrived here. I told you what happened, what I saw. How any merciful God could let that happen, I don't know. And nothing has happened since that night to change my mind, quite the opposite. You have to believe in something.
I do. I believe in you and me, and getting out of here, and making a life together where we can.
I know. Whenever and wherever we want, she sighs. Oh, Lale, if only. Lale turns her around to face him.
I will not be defined by being a Jew, he says. I won't deny it, but I am a man first. A man in love with you.
And if I want to keep my faith, if it is still important to me,
I have no say in that.
Yes, you do.
They fall into an uneasy silence. He watches her, her eyes downcast.
I have no problem with you keeping your faith, says Lale gently. In fact, I will encourage your faith if it means a lot to you and keeps you by my side. When we leave here, I will encourage you to practice your faith. When our babies come along, they can follow their mother's faith. Does that satisfy you?
Babies?
I don't know if I will be able to have children. I think I'm screwed up inside.
Once we leave here, and I can fatten you up a little, we will have babies. And they will be beautiful babies. They will take after their mother.
Thank you, my love. You make me want to believe in a future.
Good. Does that mean you will tell me your surname and where you come from?
Not yet. I told you on the day we leave this place. Please don't ask me again.
After parting from Gita, Lale seeks out Leon and a few others from Block 7.
It's a beautiful summer's day, and he intends to enjoy the sun and his friends while he can. They sit against the wall of one of the blocks. Their conversation is simple.
At the sound of the siren, Lale says his goodbyes and makes his way back to his block.
As he nears the building, he senses something is wrong. The Romani children stand around, not running to meet him, but stepping aside as he walks by. He greets them, but they don't respond. He understands why immediately when he opens the door to his room. Displayed on his bed are the gems and currency from under his mattress. Two SS officers are waiting.
Care to explain this, Tatoviera?
Lale can find no words. One of the officers snatches Lale's bag from his hands and empties his tools and ink bottles onto the floor. Then they put the bounty into the bag. With pistols drawn, they face Lale squarely and motion for him to move. The children stand aside as Lale is marched out of the gypsy camp for what he believes will be the last time. Lale stands in front of Halsteck, the contents of his bag spread out over the Oberscharführer's desk.
Halsteck picks up and examines each precious stone and piece of jewelry one at a time.
"Where did you get all this?"
he asks, not looking up.
"Prisoners gave it to me."
"Which prisoners?"
"I do not know their names."
Halsteck looks up at Lale, sharp.
"You don't know who gave you all this?"
"No, I do not."
"I meant to believe that?"
"Yes, sir. They bring it to me, but I do not ask them their names."
Halsteck slams his fist on the desk, causing the gems to jangle.
"This makes me very angry, Tetoviera." "You are good at your job. Now I will have to find someone else to do it."
He turns to the escorting officers.
"Take him to Block 11. He'll soon remember the names there."
Lale is marched out and placed in a truck. Two SS officers sit either side of him, each ramming a pistol into his ribs. During the 4-kilometer drive, Lale silently says goodbye to Gita and the future they were just imagining. Closing his eyes, he mentally says the names of each of his family members.
He cannot picture his siblings as clearly as he used to. His mother he can see perfectly. But how do you say goodbye to your mother? The person who gave you breath, who taught you how to live. He cannot say goodbye to her. He gasps as his father's image comes before him, causing one of the officers to push his pistol harder into his ribs. The last time he saw his father, he was crying. He doesn't want this to be how he remembers him, so he searches for another image and comes up with his father working with his beloved horses. He always spoke so warmly to them in contrast to the way he expressed himself to his children.
Lale's brother Max, older and wiser. He tells him he hopes he hasn't let him down, that he has tried to act as Max would have in his place. When he thinks of his little sister, Goldie, the pain is too much. The truck comes to a sudden halt, throwing Lale against the officer next to him. He is placed in a small room in Block 11. The reputation of Blocks 10 and 11 are well known. They are the punishment blocks. Behind these secluded torture houses stands the Black Wall. The execution wall. Lale expects that he will be taken there after being tortured.
For 2 days he sits in the cell, the only light coming in through a crack under the door. While he listens to the cries and screams of others, he relives every moment he has spent with Gita.
On the 3rd day, he is blinded by sunlight spilling into the room. A large man blocks the doorway and hands him a bowl of liquid. Lale takes it, and as his eyes adjust, he recognizes the man.
"Jakob, is that you?"
Jakob enters the room, the low ceiling forcing him to stoop.
"Tetoviera, what are you doing here?"
Jakob is visibly shocked.
Lale struggles to his feet, his hand outstretched.
"I often wondered what happened to you," he says.
"As you predicted, they found work for me."
"So you're a guard?"
"Not just a guard, my friend."
Jakob's voice is grim.
"Sit and eat, and I will tell you what I do here, and what will happen to you."
Apprehensively, Lale sits and looks at the food Jakob has given him.
A thin, dirty broth containing a single piece of potato. Starving a few moments ago, he finds his appetite has now left him.
"I have never forgotten your kindness," Jakob says. "I was sure I would die of starvation the night I arrived here, and there you were to feed me."
Well, you need more food than most.
I've heard stories of you smuggling food. Are they true?
That's why I'm in here. The prisoners working in the Canada smuggle me money and gems, and I use them to buy food and medicine from the villages which I distribute. I guess someone missed out and told on me.
You don't know who.
Do you?
No, it's not my job to know. My job is to get names from you. Names of prisoners who might be planning to escape or resist. And of course, the names of the prisoners who get the money and jewels to you.
Lale looks away. The enormity of what Jakob is saying begins to register.
Like you, Teto Vieira, I do what I have to do to survive.
Lale nods.
I am to beat you until you give me names. I am a killer,
Lale. Lale shakes his hanging head, mutters every swear word he knows.
I have no choice.
Mixed emotions race through Lale. Names of dead prisoners flit through his mind. Could he give Jakob those names?
No. They'll find out eventually and then I'll be back here again.
The thing is, Jakob says, I can't let you give me any names.
Lale stares, confused.
You were kind to me and I will make the beating look worse than it is. But I will kill you before I let you tell me a name. I want as little innocent blood on my hands as possible, Jakob explains.
Oh, Jakob, I never imagined this would be the work they found for you. I'm so sorry.
If I must kill one Jew to save 10 others, then I will.
Lale reaches his hand up to the large man's shoulder.
Do what you have to.
Speak only in Yiddish, says Jakob, turning away. I don't think the SS here know you, or that you speak German.
Okay, Yiddish it is.
I'll be here again later.
Back in the darkness, Lale ponders his fate. He resolves to speak no names.
It is now a matter of who kills him. A bored SS officer whose supper is getting cold, or Jakob, carrying out a just killing to save others. A sense of calm comes over him as he resigns himself to death.
Will someone tell Gita what happened to him, he wonders?
Or will she spend the rest of her life never knowing?
Lale falls into a deep, exhausted sleep.
Where is he? His father roars, storming into the house.
Once again, Lale has not turned up to work. His father is late home for supper because he had to do Lale's work for him. Lale runs and tries to hide behind his mother, pulling her away from the bench where she stands, putting a barrier between himself and his father. She reaches back and grabs hold of whatever part of Lale or his clothing she can, protecting him from what would otherwise be a cuff over the head at the least. His father doesn't force her away or make any further attempt to reach Lale.
I'll deal with him, his mother says. After dinner, I'll punish him. Now sit down.
Lale's brother and sister roll their eyes. They've seen and heard it all before. Later that evening, Lale promises his mother he will try to be more helpful to his father. But it is so hard to help his father out. Lale fears he will end up like him, old before his time. Too tired to pay his wife a simple compliment about her looks or the food she spends all day preparing for him. That is not who Lale wants to be.
I'm your favorite, aren't I, Mama?
Lale would ask.
If the two of them were alone in the house, his mother would hug him tightly.
Yes, my darling, you are.
If his brother or sister were present.
You are all my favorites.
Lale never heard his brother or sister ask this question, but they might have in his absence. When he was a young boy, he would often announce to his family that he was going to marry his mother when he grew up. His father would pretend not to hear. His siblings would goad Lale into a fight, pointing out that their mother was already married.
After breaking up their fights, his mother would take him aside and explain to him that he would find someone else one day to love and care for. He never wanted to believe her. As he became a young man, he would run home to his mother each day for the hugged greeting, the feel of her comforting body, her soft skin, the kisses she planted on his forehead.
"What can I do to help you?"
he would say.
"You're such a good boy. You will make someone a wonderful husband one day. Tell me what to do to be a good husband. I don't want to be like Papa. He doesn't make you smile. He doesn't help you. Your Papa works very hard to earn money for us to live." "I know, but can't he do both? Earn money and make you smile?" "You have a lot to learn before you grow up, young man." "Then teach me. I want the girl I marry to like me, to be happy with me."
Lale's mother sat down, and he took a seat across from her.
"You must first learn to listen to her. Even if you are tired, never be too tired to listen to what she has to say. Learn what she likes, and more importantly, what she doesn't like. When you can, give her little treats. Flowers, chocolates. Women like these things."
"When was the last time Papa brought you a treat?"
"It doesn't matter. You want to know what girls want, not what I get. When I've got money, I'll bring you flowers and chocolates, I promise. You should save your money for the girl who captures your heart."
"How will I know who she is?"
"Oh, you'll know."
She drew him into her arms and stroked his hair. Her boy. Her young man. Her image dissolves. Tears. The picture blurs. He blinks. And he imagines Geeta in his arms, him stroking her hair.
"You are right, Mama. I do know."
Jakob comes for him. He drags him down a corridor to a small windowless room. A single light bulb hangs from the ceiling. Handcuffs dangle from a chain on the back wall. There is a birch rod lying on the floor.
Two SS officers talk together, seemingly oblivious to Lale's presence. He shuffles backwards, not raising his eyes above the floor. Without warning, Jakob swings a punch into Lale's face, sending him stumbling back against the wall. The officers now pay attention. Lale attempts to stand. Jakob winds his right foot slowly back. Lale anticipates the coming kick. He backs away just as Jakob's foot connects with his ribs, then exaggerates the impact by rolling and heaving and clutching his chest. As he slowly rises, Jakob punches him again in the face. He takes the full force this time, though Jakob had telegraphed his intention to hit him. Blood runs freely from his smashed nose. Jakob pulls Lale roughly to his feet and handcuffs him to the dangling chain. Jakob picks up the birch, tears the shirt from Lale's back and lashes him 5 times. Then he pulls Lale's trousers and underpants down and whips him across the buttocks 5 more times. Lale's yelps are not feigned. Jakob jerks Lale's head back. "Give us the names of the prisoners who steal for you," Jakob says, firm and menacing. The officers look on, standing casually. Lale shakes his head, whimpering.
"I don't know."
Jakob strikes Lale 10 more times. Blood runs down his legs. The two officers begin to pay more attention and step closer. Jakob jerks Lale's head back and snarls at him.
"Talk!"
he whispers in his ear.
"Say you don't know and then faint."
And then louder,
"Give us the names!" "I never ask. I don't know. You have to believe me."
Jakob punches Lale in the stomach. He buckles at the knees, rolls his eyes back and pretends to pass out. Jakob turns to the SS officers. "He is a weak Jew. If he knew the names, he would have told us by now." He kicks Lale's legs as he dangles from the chains. The officers nod and walk from the room. The door closes and Jakob quickly releases Lale, laying him gently on the floor. With a cloth hidden in his shirt,